So it would be great to hear from maybe off the back of that, the Mental Health Resistance Network. We've got. Oh, or did you want to go a bit later?
It's
Sorry.
fine.
No, great. Mental Health Resistance Network. We've got Debbie and Ben, and maybe you could speak a little bit to that idea of like long-term sustainability as well, if that's.
Okay, well, I've prepared something to say. So, hello, I'm Debbie from the Mental Health Resistance Network. I'm here to share something about our work and about myself. So, my first experience of a psychiatric ward was in Letterkenny in Donegal in the northwest of Ireland in 1985, following a severe trauma that happened to me while I was living on a crazy commune on an island off the northwest coast when I was 19. I'd swum 3 miles in the middle of the night to get away, covered in cuts and bruises and psychotic the whole way. I found my way to a small fishing port called Burtonport and was taken by the fishermen to the local hospital, where I was treated for hypothermia and injected because, although ostensibly calm, I thought the nurses and the doctor were agents of the devil who were going to kill me. The next day I was severely psychotic and thought I could hear news reports on the radio saying that World War III was underway and could see nukes in the sunny sky about to fall over Ireland. I was transferred to the main psychiatric unit in the county at Letterkenny under sedation again and woke up to find myself on a female ward where people were being given what was known as sleeping treatment. This consisted of rows of hospital beds like a medical ward where people were kept asleep with medication, woken to eat meals in bed off the bedside table on wheels that was put over the bed, and then promptly given more medication to go back to sleep. I don't know how long I was there before the staff tried to find out who I was, but I was so severely traumatised by that point that I didn't know my name or any details about myself. The case came to the attention of the Irish Parliament, the Irish press, and questions were raised about it in Parliament. And at visiting times, the curtains were drawn around my bed and a nurse stood on guard to prevent any reporters from sneaking in to try and get a story. Eventually, a reporter traced my benefit claim at the benefits office in Dunloe near Burtonport, where we used to come over in a small boat with an outboard motor to sign on for the commune every fortnight. This reporter traced my mum somehow and phoned her at work in Debenhams in Leeds, where I'm from, and said, "Is this your daughter?" My mum knew I'd gone to the commune, but no more than that, as it was completely cut off and self-sufficient with no telephones, no electricity and so on. But she said she nearly dropped. Her and one of my brothers came over by car to bring me home. It was after nearly 3 months and I couldn't remember what they looked like before they arrived. I was told the day before that they were coming to see me. They brought clothes and we were told to go back by overnight ferry from Belfast with tickets that the hospital had booked and to go straight to our bunks as there would still be reporters trying to get the story. The case never came to court as I was deemed to be incapacitated and unable to give evidence for what had happened in a trial. I spent a few days at home and was then transferred to a large women's psychogeriatric ward in Leeds, as that was the only bed available, where I spent a further 3 months. A couple of years later, the commune bought some ex-Amazon land in Colombia and moved over there, where they live to this day, sadly now using guns to protect themselves from the armed Colombians living nearby, who often carry out armed raids on horseback. There are many newspaper stories about them on the internet. I was not the first to get away under desperate circumstances, and there were atrocities that happened to them in Colombia as well that still go on to this day. I got to London when I was 25 and ended up in psychiatric hospital again. So I'd ended up with this recurring psychotic condition because of that initial trauma, which is now diagnosed as schizoaffective disorder, which seems to be triggered by stress. I met someone called Robert Della in there who had just started work for City and Hackney Mind, and his role was to get an advocacy project off the ground, which was the first in the country, and he was doing like a recce that day at the old Hackney Hospital. When I got discharged and was living in temporary accommodation, I contacted him to become a volunteer for his project, and from then on I've worked in the user movement in London, sometimes paid and sometimes not, for organisations like City and Hackney Mind, Advocacy Project, Survivors Poetry, Southwark Association for Mental Health, Hackney Patients Council, Southwark Mind and so on, always working to promote the interests of psychiatric patients and fight for our rights. I was one of the original members of Mad Pride, which we began in the late 90s and which has sparked a global movement. and organised the one-day festival in Clissold Park in 2001, which I think is on the internet as well, attended by 4,000 nutters, punks and anarchists. Robert Deller, who I worked with on and off for over 25 years, and who sadly passed away from pancreatic cancer that he didn't know he had in 2016, age 52, writes about it all hilariously in his autobiography, Splitting in Two. My concern was and is how vulnerable we are as survivors, as a community. Sectioning is necessarily a subjective exercise, as is all of psychiatry, and is wide open to abuse. The recent Mental Health Act review did nothing to strengthen our rights, and conditions in psychiatric hospitals are no better than they ever were. And now there are millions of people cut off from life-saving support services as the cuts hit us more and more, and people are threatened with benefits cuts and sanctions all the time. In Mud Pride, a direct action group, and now the Mental Health Resistance Network, we believe in being visible. So calling fellow survivors together to stand on the streets and make our point publicly. This is a huge risk for us and is a scary thing for us to do. The last big protest that MHRN carried out was outside, it was called a keynote seminar on mental health on the 20th of November last year, hosted by Westminster Health Forum at Overseas House near St James's Park. And we heard about this seminar and saw that as part of the decisions that day to plan the next 5 years of mental health services in England, a paper was to be presented written by Lord Carter of Coles, which recommends a further £1 billion worth of cuts to be made to mental health services by 2020. Major charities like National Mind, who were a huge sellout, and Johnson & Johnson and so on, were invited to bid for private tenders and get a slice of the cake. And even Claire Murdoch herself, who is the director of NHS England and tasked with fronting up the privatisation of the NHS, was going to be the chair. So amongst ourselves, we wrote an open letter to Claire Murdoch, copies of which I have, which I can give to people at the end. Sorry, it's in a draft copy, there's a couple of details missing, I've printed out the wrong one, which states our position as mental health service users. It went to every MP, all the charities, mental health professionals, unions, the press, as well as all the other groups in our user movement. It resulted in her dropping out as chair the day before the conference, but we've never received a response to it. One of our bigger demos this year will involve marching to present a copy to her directly where she works and demanding a response within 3 months. We have people inside the seminar who had obtained tickets and were there to challenge directly, and Denise McKenna just managed to torch one of the people who was coming out. Was, you know, extremely toxic stuff. She said it was just all so toxic, it was unbelievable. And the rest of us were outside. We arrived at 8 in the morning to catch the attention of people as they came into the seminar, and we stood outside in the freezing rain for 6 hours, which was the duration of the conference, with all our banners and placards, making speeches and reassuring each other with our portable PA. And over a dozen times, the security guards from Overseas House were sent out to try to forcibly rip our banners and placards from out of our hands and screaming abuse at us, threatening to call the police, even though we were completely peaceful and committing no crime. Staff from Overseas House came out to carry on the bullying and threats, and the intimidation went on for 6 hours. The level of hostility directed at us was unbelievable, and even the CEO of the Overseas League came out to yell at us, good and proper, but changed her mind about actually calling the police then and there when she saw how peaceful and unprovocable we were and that there was no actual charge against us. In the current political climate, it's clear that intolerance is at an all-time high, and we applaud other groups who take similar risks as us to make their point. We analysed the situation afterwards in our collective and came to the conclusion that even when we are completely passive and presenting our argument in as visual a form as possible, we must represent what other people must and have always feared in themselves, and therefore what must be got rid of and eradicated completely rather than brought to light and dealt with, which would be painful and raise quite uncomfortable questions. Their sustained and hostile threats to call the police, we thought, were a fantasy about seeing us all being hauled off in police vans and sectioned en masse. And they were desperate to criminalise us somehow and, of course, treat us as scapegoats for wider dis-ease, as ever. And that moment of power that they thought they held when they thought they could make this happen, and I'm sure they tried to call out the police, brought out the pack mentality in them, especially because that day we were actually a very passive bunch of mostly people with diagnoses such as schizophrenia, whatever that means, and people who self-harm and have attempted suicide. And so we're very passive really that day. We've always encountered hostility from the wider public when we've taken to the streets, but never at this kind of level, and it was shocking. Still, it was personally deeply satisfying to make our point publicly. We demand document written specially to underpin this protest that I have some copies of with me today, sets out our agenda as mental health service user campaigners and includes many points from other groups and individuals who are invited to contribute to it. We decided at this juncture to throw everything at them that we've ever campaigned for in the last 25 years and call for a complete change of culture to try and restore services and arrest the narrative that is emerging that people with mental distress are somehow fakers who just need to stop feeling sorry for themselves and get out to work. I'm sure I don't need to describe here the extremity of experience that many people with mental distress go through, which can be completely and permanently shattering. In Leeds, where I grew up, I saw it firsthand how poverty can impact not only on life chances, but create the self-belief needed to rise above your circumstances and be ambitious, how childhood abuse and neglect and racism can be the ghosts that never go away. And many of the kids that I knew in Leeds were completely feral, looking after each other as best they could with very little money to go around. There were no jobs to be had. Obviously, kids are going to end up in crime and all with mental health problems, and addiction is rife. Abuse gets perpetuated, especially violence. Kids end up in the system, which is usually a prison sentence over there, and it's very hard to shake all that off and start afresh. Generations of want are produced that become the norm, and we are the permanent backdrop to any sporadic attempts to regenerate or gentrify or simply bulldoze inner city areas that we don't want to see anymore. We rarely look at the problems in the face, and remediating all of that costs money and requires proper funding. I strongly feel that Brexit is not the answer to these ongoing problems, but it has been presented as the only answer for our society, like the Nazis' so-called final solution. The last demo that we did was a joint action with an organisation called Winvisible for women with invisible disabilities as part of the Global Women's Strike on March the 8th this year. We amassed outside the Royal Courts of Justice and made speeches demanding investigation into psychiatric and abuse, for example, women who are kept in their rooms in units for people with autism, sometimes for years, given forcible medication, and the high level of reported sexual abuse and rapes on mixed wards in psychiatric hospitals in so-called safe environments, and especially on long-stay so-called rehab wards, which are usually away from the busy acute wards and can be hellish examples of the worst kind of practice. We have always have performance poetry at our demos as well, from survivor performance poets who are really excellent, brilliant performers, and we're attracting bigger names like the rapper poet at Whisper, who supported Spectre last year. I also organised a survivor's poetry. I've got some flyers here for those events as well. And everyone is welcome to attend any of our events. And it means a lot to us when good mainstream artists want to get involved with us, like John Hegley, Jenny Bellstar from the 80s all-girl pop band The Bellstars, Billy Childish, Michael Rosen. Because essentially we are still the pariahs at the bottom of the heap who nobody really wants to hang out with. We are still the strange people who act funny and disappear off to the funny farm, often rejected by our families, mostly regarded as simple and weird and kind of untouchable, when in fact we're a community of people with enormously high respect and understanding and compassion for each other, who will always try to help each other out. A community that I am so proud to belong to and tell people about, which constantly inspires me and gives me the will to keep on carrying on. So it's the burning injustices and the abuse of rights that still prevail that keep many of us as activists, even though after a decade or two, most of us would rather just have a quiet life. But that's the thing about survivors. They will never walk away from each other. And while there are still issues that need to be addressed and individuals go through torment and isolation, we will still fight on to reach each other and stand together for a better future, because we need each other, and quite often no one else wants to have anything to do with us. I will hand you over to Ben Ellsworth now, a gifted young man trained to be an art therapist and a valued member of NHRN, who is going to talk to you about some other subjects and give us some of his perspective.
Thanks, Debbie. Very quickly, So this year, the focus of MHRN is on the work as a health outcome, which is, you know, it's part of the NHS 10-year plan. And it's not to undermine and say that employment isn't bad for your health, but it's to counter the claim that all employment is good for your health. So it's basically the current government review shows that it's not generally harmful or beneficial for your mental health if you have a severe mental health illness, but it doesn't talk about the quality of your job at all. And we want to challenge the Royal College of Psychiatrists, the government, and the NHS on this front, and get them to remove it from the 10-year plan. So Amber Rudd, the Tory Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, has come up with a scheme to give Department for Work and Pension work coaches new abilities to refer people to treatment from the job centre. So that's the plan. And we're saying this is completely inappropriate for mental health treatment. And it should, you know, Mind themselves have said it should be delivered in a calm and therapeutic environment by trained professionals with knowledge. And if people feel pressured to receive treatment which is not right for them in a job centre, it can be really damaging. People with mental health problems dread encounters at job centres, as they concern your benefits will be stopped and you're going to be scared, you're going to be sanctioned, essentially. So it kind of, just to wrap up, it ties into this strivers and skivers thing, which individualises distress and mental health distress. And for me, just to wrap up, I'm on training, and what I realise is that the therapeutic ethos is predominantly quite individualising. And instead of looking out, you look in. And that touches on something that people are inherently flawed or faulty, which is essentially a myth. So for me, I was very isolated at uni, spouting these views, which made a lot of sense, and it just falling on deaf ears. Appropriately, my course director on art therapy training was a Tory counsellor. So, you know, for me, it was really important to connect with groups and feel connected. And in terms of long-term sustainability, I think, you know, for me, I get rejuvenated from having people with these views, but I think it's also about, you know, what resources do you have to maintain your solidarity? So if you have food and childcare at an event or a protest, I think that can be really helpful. Because I think a lot of this is about resources. What resources do you have access to in your social world? Therapy often is most helpful for the people who need it least. I'll leave it there.
Thank you so much.
We've got Sina as well, just to...
Hi, Sina. So we're running a little over on time. Would you mind if I came back to you afterwards,
Sina?
No, is that okay? Great. Just so we manage to make sure we hear from all of the groups, and then we'll hear from Sina from the Mental Health Resistance Network. Cool. So could we hear from Laura from ECP?
Yes. Hi, thank you. The ECP is the English Collective of Prostitutes, and we're a sex worker organisation, and I'm really pleased to speak after mental health resistance, because what you said about feeling like pariahs, that's how we feel as well. And so because we're criminalised as sex workers, but actually we are part of the same movement, and we don't want to be separated. We're part of the same movements for less work, more money, against austerity, against the benefit cuts and sanctions, which has caused a massive increase in prostitution across the country, and also against the criminalisation of survival, of which prostitution is just one of the many ways that we're criminalised. So just to say, we're quite old compared to some of the other groups because we've been going since 1975. We started because we were inspired by church occupations and a strike of sex workers in France in 1975, which was against a lot of violence that was happening and police harassment. And two migrant women in England formed the English Collective of Prostitutes. That's where the name came from. And they came together to form a group to campaign against what they called then the abolition of the prostitution laws and for economic alternatives. And I'll speak a bit more about a little bit about what laws we're up against, because we're still up against the same ones. But just to say a bit more about us, we're sex workers who are working on the street and in premises. We have a national and an international network, so we work internationally as well. And we are a multiracial network and also are migrant and non-migrant. And just to give you a bit of an idea of the work that we've done over the years, we do campaigning and advice work and casework, and obviously the two influence each other. But over the years, our work includes protesting the horrific murders of 13 women by the Yorkshire Ripper and the official disregard of sex workers' lives by the police and the establishment. We occupied a church in King's Cross in London in 1982 to protest police illegality and racism against street workers. In 1995, we did the first ever successful private prosecution for rape in England and Wales, which put a serial rapist behind bars. Then later, we formed the Safety First Coalition in the aftermath of the tragic murder of five women in Ipswich in 2006, which includes organisations like the Royal College of Nursing and Women Against Rape, who are a bit more prestigious than a sex worker organisation. And then our kind of advice work includes defending sex workers on the street against civil orders used to criminalise and ban you from particular areas, not just working, from being there at all, and opposing gentrification and the closure of sex workers' flats in Soho in central London, because it's safer to work inside. That's why we oppose the closures. And also again, for migrant sex workers winning against Brexit-inspired deportation orders. I just wanted to read a bit from our first public statement, because it's still quite relevant today. Our first statement done in 1975 was called For Prostitutes Against Prostitution. And the first paragraph read, all work is prostitution, whether we work for money or room and board. All women are prostitutes, whether we fuck for money, wait on tables, pack biscuits, type letters, drive lorries, bear children, teach in schools, or work in the coal mines. We're forced to sell our bodies and minds. Our whole lives are stolen from us by work. Prostitution is in fact dangerous and hard work with not very good returns most of the time. Many are ostracised by their families, hassled by the law, subject to violence by police. The laws surrounding prostitution make it very difficult for sex workers to go about a job without endangering themselves. And today we face the same laws, we face the same problems, we face police harassment, arrest and lack of protection when we do report violence. Just to say a little bit about what the law is. The law itself actually prevents you from working together. So even though it's actually legal to work on your own, it's illegal to work with somebody else. And that obviously means that you're forced to make a decision between working on your own and not facing arrest, but facing the possibility of more danger because obviously you're on your own, or perhaps facing arrest and working with somebody else. And we don't think anyone should have to make that choice. And so that's the law that we are campaigning to abolish and get rid of. A sex worker came to us actually this week. We're fighting cases all the time, but just to give you an example from a couple of days ago, the police came to her flat where she was working with one other person for safety, her friend, and the police came in with body cameras, so now their faces are on the police camera as sex workers. And they actually took one of the women's passport details. Like, why do you need to take somebody's passport details? And now the women are terrified that they are, the police looked around and took their details, asked various questions, like how many clients they saw, how much money they make, who do they pay the rent to. And now the women are terrified that they are being investigated for prostitution offences, and then came to us for information about their rights. We launched a campaign this year on the 3rd of March, which is the International Sex Worker Rights Day, called Make All Women Safe. And that demands for decriminalisation and for the removal of the laws, and is a film and a government petition, which we have 6 months to gather signatures for. The reason that we're doing it is because the Home Affairs Committee in Parliament recommended in 2016 decriminalisation of sex workers, and the government is actually currently commissioning research into the nature and extent of prostitution in the UK. And so we want to show that we have support for decriminalisation and that we have power behind us, that they can't just go and do whatever they want. There is a movement for decriminalisation, and it's a strong one. So we want them to do what we think they should do rather than what they want. So please sign the petition. I have some leaflets here, and support our campaign for decriminalisation. Go and watch the video. Do I have any more time?
One more minute.
Okay, just to say, I guess, about longevity, just to say about a couple of the things. We're based at the Crossroads Women's Centre in North London with other women's organisations, which is a massive power for us because we're not out there on our own. And we, as well as our own victories, and we count every single victory, you know, every single time the police don't come back to women's flats, we count that as a victory. Every single time you know, somebody is not stopped on the street, that is counted as a victory. And us, alongside with the other groups, there's about 15 other organisations working in different areas. And it's the same, is counting the victories really does keep you going, because it's very, as we all know, it's very tough out there, and it's a very hard life. And so you have to count what you've got. And so every time we win, every time one of the other groups wins somebody's benefits or stops a sanction, or every time we stop a deportation, you know, we really count every single victory that we have. And that does help keep you going, as well as lunch every day that we cook collectively, and those, that kind of thing. But I think the victories does really make a massive difference.
Amazing. It's a lunch and victories.
Thank you.